You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Callen here, my colleague Hunter Motz, and our guest, our esteemed guest, is a senior attorney for the Institute for Justice, Scott Bullock. Think of them as the Libertarian ACLU. Scott, welcome to the mother of all podcasts.
Great to be here. Thanks yes. a lot.
One of your causes, and we'll jump right in, was showcased on the John Oliver Show, and that is forfeitures. And explain to us what's really going on in parts of the country like Philadelphia. Tell us what is, because I saw this video and I flipped out.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it was happening in my country, and people are getting away with it. And I, you know, just how these people live with themselves is beyond me.
Yeah, well, it is something that just shocks just about everybody who hears about the concept of civil forfeiture. You know, a lot of people understand criminal forfeiture. That's when somebody's been found guilty or pled guilty to a criminal act, and then the government says, well, we don't want people benefiting from their wrongdoing. We're going to take their ill-gotten gains. And the classic example of that is somebody like Bernie Madoff. It was shown he pled guilty, he ripped off all of his customers, he bought mansions, yachts, you know, a bunch of other things. We don't want people benefiting from that. The government can take it. You know, that process can certainly be abused, but at least in principle, people, it's legitimate. But civil forfeiture is something completely different. It's when the government can take your home, your business, your land, your cash, your car, regardless of whether or not you've been convicted or even charged with criminal activity. And that's what is so astonishing to people, is that you could lose your property without being convicted of a crime. But that's exactly what can happen under civil forfeiture. And to make matters worse, in over 40 states and at the federal level, the very people who are prosecuting these actions, prosecutors and police officials, get to keep the money and the property that they forfeit for their own use, giving them a very direct and perverse financial incentive.
That's unbelievable.
It is just a textbook way of inviting aggressive use of forfeiture and the abuse that flows from it. And it's been going on for a number of years now, but thankfully in the past few years, some of the work that we've done and others, we've been at the forefront of this fight. We have a campaign against this practice, and thankfully, especially even in the last year, awareness has really grown about this. And through our work in the courts and other forums, we're trying to change this
practice. It's criminal behavior, in my opinion. They're stealing from American citizens. You know, when you force a lady to sell her house at half price because her grandson was selling weed on the street.
Yeah. And there wasn't even any weed in the house.
How do these people live with themselves?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's amazing. And the other problem with civil forfeiture is that it's a civil proceeding. You know, so it's not even like a criminal proceeding where if you can't afford a lawyer, you have to be appointed a lawyer. Most constitutional protections apply in criminal proceedings. It's not true in civil proceedings because the action, this is the thing that is another astonishing part of the process. The action isn't against the property owner. It's against the property. So you have these case names like United States of America versus $2,600 in U.S. currency, or our case in Philadelphia where they're going after actually addresses of the homes. We had a case because
someone involved, someone affiliated with that home, someone not even necessarily the owner, but someone who lives in that home, committed a crime.
So and the action is against the property, and so therefore the property owners have to intervene to try to get their property back, but the action is against the property itself. We had a case in Texas called State of Texas versus 2004 Chevrolet Silverado. That's the name of the actual
Good
case
God.
And the property owners kind of shuffled off to the side, and there the burden is on them to try to get their property back.
So are you guys winning this fight? Are these unethical bureaucrats, abusers of power, being exposed?
Well, increasingly that's the case. But, you know, the problem with this, and, you know, there's all these outrageous tales of, you know, the forfeiture funds are being used for things like, and the John Oliver piece that you had mentioned goes into this, margarita machines and trips to law enforcement conventions, a bunch of ridiculous things. But the problem, though, is not just a couple of bad actors of, you know, people that are doing this. It's the laws themselves that permit this. And once you allow people to act this way, I mean, every economist will tell you incentives matter.
I was going to say you've created an incentive structure where even good people behave badly.
Absolutely. And you're going to have people, if you have a perverse incentive structure, people are going to start acting in perverse ways, and that's exactly what you have in the civil forfeiture system.
It's government abuse. That's what you guys are there for. Thank God, one of the few countries where you have recourse when the government comes along with all its resources and says, "Hey, this is a new law. We're going to take this from you."
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the great things about our system is that we actually have an independent court system that is there to try to protect citizens from these types of abuses. And that's what our role is we're trying to protect individuals whose rights are being violated and then set broader precedents that will protect others in similar situations and hopefully put a stop to the government doing this in the future.
Wow. That's amazing. How long have you been doing this work?
We have been doing this for a little over 20 years now. We were established in 1991, and so we're still a relatively small shop, but we've grown a lot since then. And we like to describe ourselves as the National Law Firm for Liberty. That's what we're doing. We're out protecting essential American freedoms from abuse by the government at all levels as well. I mean, we have lawsuits. We don't discriminate in the people that we sue. We have lawsuits against the federal government right now, state governments, and local governments, which can also be as tyrannical as what the federal government can be. It's sometimes even more so because they're more effective at what they're trying to do to the people.
Well, unfortunately, you sound like you're busy. In other words, unfortunately, that the abuse is alive and well.
Yeah, I mean, unquestionable. You know, we have a lot of work to do. We'd like to do more. You know, we try to do as many cases as we can, but we very selectively target the cases that we do because we want to have a case where we build public support for it, highlight an issue, so it's not just about one particular property owner or business person or citizen trying to speak freely.
Yeah, can you do a class action suit? Can you get all these people together in counties?
Yeah, Philadelphia is a class action suit. So that's something that is even going to have a broader impact than a typical lawsuit. But what we do in our cases is we focus specifically on cases where we think we can have the broadest impact, and we pick cases that have the potential to set a precedent then that will protect even people that are not a part of that particular lawsuit.
In other words, setting a precedent so it goes to the Supreme Court or at least the Supreme Court of the state?
Of the state, or an appellate court, or even decisions by trial courts can be used as precedents as well. And even if the government doesn't abide by them, you have that on your side. And we can sue on behalf of citizens, or somebody else can, to make sure these precedents are effective.
Well, what about making this politically liable to the next group of people that want to run? How about saying to the mayor and the governor and all your local politicians, hey, a-holes, can you guys stop this practice? Because you're stealing from American citizens.
Well, I mean, that's something that, you know, once you, and it's one of the reasons why we argue not just in the court of law, but the court of public opinion as well. Because, you know, oftentimes government officials, you know, they don't like being sued, and that can lead to a lot of problems. But that could take a long time to get to that resolution. But if they're hearing about this and they're being asked questions like, why are you doing this? Why are you trying to take people's property? Why are you preventing this person from starting a business? That can be something they're even more concerned about.
Sure.
Because the average citizen then knows what they're doing. So that's why we always get the word out about our cases and just tell the stories of our clients.
And I think one of the interesting things from having poked around your website, I mean, I came across the Institute for Justice because one of our listeners, Nicholas Varinius, I want to shout out to him and say thank you. But he sent us this video about the Philadelphia forfeiture thing. And, you know, looking around your website, it's clear that you're very media savvy. Like, you're doing a really, really good job of making sure that there are YouTube videos, you know, that you're shooting it in ways that are emotionally engaging.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for saying that. That's a deliberate thing that we're doing. And what we're really doing is highlighting the human toll of these types of laws and regulations. And we mainly highlight, if you look at this, this isn't me or other lawyers. I mean, we're here to talk about some of the legal principles, but it's really our clients that are telling their stories. And, you know, these are people that are, you know, have not done anything wrong. They're just trying to get into business or hold on to their home that they've worked so hard to obtain, and they're being met with these outrageous abuses.
We had Barb Oakley on, who wrote a book called Mind for Numbers, and she asked us why we thought libertarianism wasn't more popular. You guys have been around for 20 years now. Libertarianism is something that does seem to be on the rise. You know, what do you, I don't know if you feel comfortable saying this, but what is your feel of what's happening with libertarianism, why it's becoming more popular, and, you know, how far can it go?
Sure. Well, it's something that I think speaks to people's desires. You know, the four areas that we focus on are economic liberty, private property rights, educational choice, and freedom of speech. Four essential freedoms that all libertarians, and I think most Americans, support. The ability to pursue an occupation unfree of government, unreasonable government interference. That's just the right to earn an honest living. Everybody can understand that. The right to own and continue to use your property as you see fit. The right to educate your children the way you wish, and the school that you choose. And the ability to freely speak your mind, whether about political issues or commercial matters.
Sounds like human rights to me.
Absolutely. And that's something, I mean, you know, when people ask us, what's your philosophical orientation, we certainly say we're libertarian, but those four fundamental freedoms, the pillars of our work, as we call them, are something that most Americans get, understand, and support, regardless of whether or not they're kind of, you know, understand the principles of libertarianism and have read the authors that, you know, probably all of us have read. And once you expose people to human stories, and I think that's something where sometimes libertarians get a little bit too caught up in debating theory and doctrine and that sort of thing, and I like those discussions, and they appeal to me, but most people respond to stories of what's happening to themselves or to somebody that they can relate to.
Well,
and that's one of the things we put a human face on our work.
My father is a libertarian, and he would always, and he's a bit extreme probably, but he would always say government primarily does two things, and both those things are coercive. You need them to a degree, but they pass laws and they issue taxes, and you need both of those things, but it's a question to what degree. That always seems to be where the debate lies. And the other thing that government seems to do, if left on its own, is grow.
Absolutely.
And we have we were just talking about the kind of traffic you have to deal with in where you live down in Washington, D.C. It's some of the worst in the country, and those counties around D.C. are some of the richest in the country, and yet they don't really produce anything. It's an economy of influence.
Yep, that's exactly right. But you know, one of the great things we have is a constitution. Mm-hmm. But the challenge every generation really is that you need people to stand up for their rights, because if not, then if you don't have that, then the Constitution is just a words on an old piece of paper. So you need principled people that are going to say, listen, I'm not only going to fight for my rights, but in so doing, fight for the rights of all the people in the country. And then you also need advocates in the courtroom to make sure that those rights that are set forth in the Constitution are actually protected, and that judges play their role of reining in abuses by the legislature and the executive, and to try to put those limits that are in the Constitution on government officials today and in 2014 and beyond. And that's one of the great things of the people, and you saw it on our videos, it's on our website, ij.org, of the people that we represent that are fighting this fight. And at first it might be just only saving their property or protecting their rights, but then they understand what's at stake, and they become very dedicated to trying to protect the rights of just about everybody else in similar situation.
I mean, obviously, I mean, I think perhaps, I mean, this happens every generation, but this is particularly a moment where we're really trying to make sense of the Constitution. And it's always very easy for people to point at the failings of the Constitution, the Three-Fifths Compromise, and there are many, many parts of it that, you know, are anachronistic. But I think it's really fantastic that you guys have defined those four basic pillars, because I really, I mean, that is something that I think every human being can agree on.
It's like William Bernstein's book, The Birth of Plenty, where he kind of goes through why some nations...
Well, and there's a huge amount of overlap there in terms of, you know, freedom of thought, property rights. Like, it's the same basic things.
What, how do you guys get paid? You're hired to defend, people hire you to defend themselves against the government, right?
That's right. Well, people don't pay us. We are a nonprofit 501c3, so we rely on people who believe in what we're doing. Most of our support, about 80%, comes from individuals, 20% comes from foundations. The people that we represent really probably could not pay for a lawyer, and that's one of the huge clubs that the government has against the average citizen, is that they know most people simply cannot afford a lawyer to fight back. So either they don't fight, or they have to reach some type of settlement or compromise with the government, because they would be financially ruined if they kept fighting. So we can step in, and because we're not charging our clients, we can fight these battles. And then we get paid, as I said, from charitable contributions as a nonprofit in order to wage these battles.
You're a good person, Scott Bullock. You are for real.
Did you always, I mean, this, you know, have you been with the Institute for Justice for its full 20-year history? What's your personal story?
I have been. You know, I've been here since the very beginning. I was the lawyer, you know, fresh out of law school, that really always wanted to do this. This was my dream, is to do this type of work. And thankfully, IJ was formed the year I graduated from law school. I'd worked for like-minded organizations and dedicated myself to doing that. And then it was started by our two co-founders, Chip Meller and Clint Bullock. But it was just the three of us and a couple support staff, and now we've got close to 40 lawyers and offices in five states right now. So we're still relatively small, but we've really grown since that time and have a good track record of success in waging these fights. But everybody here is dedicated to these principles. Oftentimes they could, you know, be out in private practice and collecting a big paycheck and doing that, but they've chosen to do this type of work and to defend these freedoms.
Well, you know, and God, do I appreciate that, and I think I'm sure everybody you helped does too. But when somebody, my friend told me that when he's audited, you can get audited by the government, and they can really, I mean, they can really audit the hell out of you, where you have to hire lawyers and everything else. And then when they don't find anything, they say, see ya, thanks, and you're left with these huge legal bills and all this time you had to spend in producing all kinds of documents and everything else. Is there a recourse for people like that?
Well, it's tough to do. You know, some statutes now, thankfully, have attorney's fees provisions, so you can at least get your attorney's fees bills paid. But that's a hard slog. The government, of course, doesn't want to pay those bills. And it's sad sometimes because, of course, the taxpayers ultimately have to pick up the tab for that. Mm-hmm. But at least provide some type of compensation for the people that have fought this. That's not true in many instances. Very hard to get attorney's fees from the federal government, although in certain circumstances you can, and we have done so in certain limited circumstances. But it is something that most people... For instance, one of the issues that we've fought on for years is the fight against eminent domain abuse, where the government takes your property not for a public use as authorized by the Constitution, a road, a bridge, a public building, but for private economic development. And you have government transferring land from one private owner to another private owner.
That's crazy. I didn't know that existed. Explain that. Dilate on that a little bit.
Yeah, so this is something that was a controversy. It arose, again, because courts were not recognizing constitutional limits, and eminent domain was considered to be a longstanding power of the government, but the Constitution says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. So it recognizes the government can take your property at certain times, but it can only do so if it first pays just compensation. And oftentimes, that's not what the government really pays. But the only time that the government can take your property or should be able to take your property if it is for a public use, and that typically is a public works project, a road or a reservoir, something along those lines. But because of neglect by the courts, governments then started using eminent domain to take property to give to condominium developers or casinos or big box retail stores. And the government twisted the words of the Constitution so that public use really meant public benefit. And the argument was, well, the public will benefit, and really the government will benefit from higher taxes and more tax revenue and greater job growth and an improved economy. And so we're going to take somebody's private property and hand it over to a private owner that we happen to like better.
God.
And that's something that, is entirely incredibly abusive of people's rights. It's exactly the opposite of what the Constitution intended. But because courts allowed governments for so long to get away with it, there was nobody really there to stop it. And most citizens could not fight it, because if they tried to fight eminent domain and they said, I just want to hold on to my property, they could say, well, you could spend $50,000 trying to hold on to your, or $100,000 trying to hold on to your $80,000 house, or you can just take the offer that we're making to you.
Sure.
And leave for it. So again, it's one of these situations where
you're pitted against the government's resources, which you can never win.
That's right. And oftentimes what you have too, and in a lot of our cases, is it's the government teaming up with business interests in order to stomp on the individual and to try to either eliminate competition or to try to take property on the cheap.
And is that kind of behavior on the rise, or is it not?
It has been for a number of years. I think we're seeing some curtailment of it right now in several of the cases that we've done. But many of our cases are established businesses teaming up with government in order to basically screw the little guy. And I'm sure you've talked about this on your show before. It's the fundamental difference between being pro-business and being pro-free market.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes established business interests are not on the side of markets.
Exactly.
They want to use government power.
You mean like
to
the banks?
To try to further their own ends. So that's the thing that we're always emphasizing. We're trying to say, listen, we're on the side of freedom and free markets. And as I said, oftentimes our lawsuits, they're always against the government, but we're fighting against a big developer or an established taxi cab company or something along those lines that have teamed up with the government to stop people from entering into business or take their property or something along those lines.
And that's one of the biggest misunderstandings about libertarianism, I think, in the minds of the general public, is they think libertarianism is pro-business when it's really pro-free markets.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, it's an individual liberty. Lawrence Lessig in his book Republic Lost would have an answer for a lot of this. I don't know if you read the book or if you're familiar with his work.
I have not. I know a little bit about the work, but I haven't
read
the book.
About campaign finance reform, money in politics, and how as long as people, politicians, we're back to incentive structures again. I mean, one of the theme of his book, I think, is unique, is that Washington is structured so that corruption, good people, have to behave in a corrupt manner to get ahead or to stay in power. That's when you know you're in real trouble. Usually you get 2% of the population, whoever they are, they're corrupt and they're bad and they're doing things. But most people, probably in Washington, most politicians trying to make the world a better place like we all are. But,
well, or alternatively, I think that's the other phenomenon, is because the system is so screwed up.
Yeah.
Only screwed up people stay in that system.
It
attracts
bad
actors.
Point too. Sure. That's a good point. But Scott, what would we do? What do you think needs to be done to change the issue systemically? Is this, since it's on the rise, is the collusion between business and government, is that a function of the way our government, the way one gets elected, campaign finance laws, political action committees, is that what's going on?
It's a symptom of it. You know, the problem with it is that government is so involved in doling out favors and so involved in doing this, shouldn't be surprising then that people spend a lot of money in order to take advantage of those favors. I mean, that's something that you're inevitably going to have, and anytime you try to stop it in one area, then it's just going to find its way if the benefits are there.
Yeah.
If you want to stop the system, you have to change the benefits and goodies and the size of government and the ability of government to grant these privileges and dole out this money. Well, one of the things that we're doing and something that's very important is to once again impose constitutional restraints on government, because the Constitution established a government of limited powers. That's in the Constitution. And you cannot have a situation, you can either say that, well, those limits are old-fashioned and we shouldn't have them. That's one argument, but you can't reconcile, really, the growth of the government that we have now and what is set forth in the Constitution. And one of the things that's happened and one of the things we're fighting against is the fact that courts for too long have let government get away with this. They've allowed government to grow outside its limited and defined powers that are set forth in the Constitution. So that's one of our long-term projects, is to once again have what we call an engaged judiciary, engaged judging, because that's what judges are supposed to do. That's why we have an independent judiciary, have a third branch of government. Their role is supposed to be the guardians of the Constitution. They're supposed to limit abuses and growth of government by the executive branch and by the legislature as well. And for too often, courts have just sidestepped a lot of these issues and said, well, who are we to interfere with the growth of government? That's not to say that these things are always set in stone. The Constitution does have an amendment process, and that if the people decide that, well, we want a larger government, there's an amendment process to do this. I oftentimes tell people that one of my favorite, I give a talk on the Constitution, and I put up the language of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution. And people start reading it, and they're kind of astonished when they read it, because it's the amendment that established prohibition in the country. And people start reading it, and they say, well, wait a minute, I thought you were a libertarian. How could you be in favor of prohibition? And I said, well, you know, I'm not, of course, in favor of prohibition, but it was done the right way. I mean, at that time, when the prohibition was established back in the 19-teens, there was at least enough of a residual respect for the Constitution to recognize, well, the federal government clearly doesn't have the authority to ban alcohol.
Yeah, it's got to go through the courts.
Throughout the whole country. And so they said, let's get a constitutional amendment started to give the federal government that power. Again, I disagree with it as a policy matter, but they at least went ahead and did it. Couldn't imagine doing that today for virtually anything that the government wants to do. They just assume that the power is in the Constitution, and the courts don't put a stop to it. So, you know, the prohibition was an example of, even though if I disagreed with the policy, they actually amended the Constitution the right way, and then with the 21st Amendment, they decided to get away with it. And that's what we're talking about here, is once again restoring limits on government power and authority.
But also, I mean, the idea of passing any sort of amendment through the people nowadays, with the population as divided as it is, I mean, that doesn't seem very likely. And I mean, you know, that sort of disengagement and that sort of division is a large part of why the government is able to get away with what they want, because we've lost sight of the fact that on four pillars, on certain core values, we actually do agree.
That's right. I mean, that's true. But, you know, one of the things, though, the reason why we have divided government is it is difficult to get certain things done, you know. That was done by design, so you don't have this kind of fervor to do something, and then all of a sudden, you know, the government does it, and there's really no stops that you can do. Now, that does make it more difficult to push the government in a more liberty-friendly direction, but there are still several mechanisms to do that. You know, I think one of the great things that we've seen here, and I think one something that's very encouraging, is the rise of libertarian thinking among young people as well. You know, this is something that that's been discussed, and I think it's a real phenomenon that that young people are really starting to get interested in these ideas. I'm in my 40s, and that's certainly true, you know, more so than when I was in college and when I started getting interested in these ideas. There's a lot more people that that believe in these principles and are dedicating themselves to doing. You know, a lot you mentioned on some of our videos and work. You know, these are done by, you know, typically 20-somethings that you know, could be working at some advertising agency, and they're incredibly talented, and they could, you know, do all this on their desktops, and they do amazing things with graphics and music and that sort of thing. But they became inspired by these ideas and said, "Listen, I want to work for an organization that believes in these things as well." So that's something that I find encouraging, and hopefully will continue to grow.
Here's a question for you, though. I mean, you know, we talk about the government being bloated, but is it also fair to say that the whole legal system is bloated and that the courts are bloated? And, you know, to what extent, I mean, is that something that needs to be reined in?
Well, you know, the courts, part of that is the fact that we have so many laws, have so many regulations mm-hmm. that, you know, people can't agree on these things, and they have to then battle it out. And I think a lot of that would go away if we had a more limited government, a more defined government, had a simpler set of statutes. I mean, the tax code's a classic example of that, where, you know, there's so many of these, so the tax code is so huge, of course you're going to have people battling it out over what the meaning of the thousands upon thousands of pages of the tax code actually are. So I think that's largely a function of just the growth of government then as well. But what we do need to have, though, is a judicial system that really does take limits on the Constitution seriously and imposes those limits on abuses, as I said, by the other two branches of government. I'll tell you, if you have a little bit of time, a case that we just did. You had mentioned the IRS, and we actually won a case recently against the IRS, and it was a case where this affected hundreds of thousands of people, where the IRS for years decided, they talked about, well, we would like to license all tax preparers in the country, anybody that prepares taxes, and we want to have a licensing system for them. Well, the problem with that is that Congress never gave them the power to do that. There was legislation introduced, and it was never passed. Well, in 2011, the IRS decides, well, we're just going to do this on our own. We've decided that we now do have the power to do this.
Right.
And it would affect hundreds of thousands of people that have to go to school, that have to pass an exam, that have to pay new fees, that have to take continuing education requirements for it. Now, not surprisingly, getting back to what we were talking about before of this combination of government power and business interests, the former CEO of H&R Block headed the study group that then went on to impose this licensing requirement on all tax preparers. And H&R Block had some carve-outs for the type of business model that they have, and so they were all on board with this new licensing regime. But what it was going to do, it was going to affect the independent tax preparer, the guy that might be the retired accountant that does 60 or 70 tax returns a year, and he thinks, I'm not going to pay, you know, more money at $1,000 a year, go back to school, take an exam, forget it. I'm out. And so therefore, those people that he did and that many of these thousands of other tax preparers did would obviously have to go to the big tax preparers then as well. So we represented three independent tax preparers, challenged this, and we won. We won at the district court level here in D.C., and then there was an appellate court decision that said the IRS did not have the power to do this, that Congress never gave them this power, and that they just can't assume the power for themselves. And so then that was a great victory and protected the rights of the independent tax preparers, but also set an important precedent that said that there's limits on what administrative agencies can do. They just can't make up the law as they go along and then just decide we basically have the power to do whatever we want unless Congress tells us otherwise. The rule is that, no, you only have the powers that are given to you by Congress.
When you win a case, when you, for example, this case, Who is granting in your favor? Is that a jury or a judge?
In our cases, typically a judge.
Okay. How long do those take? He's got to look at all the evidence. Has he got help?
Yeah, you know, we do a lot. I mean, a lot of it is in writing, you know, so we spend a lot of time writing the briefs. We typically have an argument before the judge and or judges and the appellate courts. And you know, it varies from time to time. I mean, courts are pretty busy, so it does take them a while sometimes to write an opinion. But, yeah, juries typically weigh the facts. You know, the facts weren't really in dispute in a lot of our cases. The government's trying to do this. We think it's unconstitutional. And then you argue the law to the judge, and then the judge makes the decision.
Awesome.
You spoke to a really important point, which is just the sheer complexity of the legal code. I mean, the thing that was most telling for me was when I found out that the Library of Congress actually doesn't know how many laws there are in the United States. Like, we don't know what the number of laws in the United States.
Really?
That's how many there are. The Library of Congress, which is huge and professionally responsible for maintaining that, doesn't know the number.
Well, and to speak to your point before you comment on that, Scott, is that remember what I think it was Rickards was talking about, Jim Rickards was talking about, and he said that if you want to get something through, a law or whatever, just couch it in very complex language, in economic terms.
In jargon.
In jargon.
Right.
And most people won't pay attention. You'll just get it through.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Complexity is a great way to disguise that. And, you know, thinking in terms of history, there are these moments, you know, the law code of the Roman Empire got so complex that Justinian had to simplify it. You know, the same thing, Napoleon with his Napoleonic Code had to simplify the law.
Hunter's very educated. Keep going.
But is there, I mean, I increasingly I just wonder, and there was a, you know, speaking of the tax preparation, there was a move to simplify the California tax code. And basically all the e-tax software, all of those companies colluded to get that shut down because they want the tax code to be complicated so that you feel like you need to buy their software. Have we reached a moment where we really need to prune the hedges and consolidate and simplify that law code so that it's more manageable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is something that ideally you would have a minimal amount of laws and clear and simple laws. That's the ideal system. And then you're right. When you have the tax code that the size that we do, then it's not surprising that you have a whole industry built up around trying to get people to solve the tax problem that they might have.
Anytime you pass a law, a cottage industry grows up around it.
Mm-hmm. And then they become vested interests that then try to game the system for their own advantage.
How much ethanol is in your car right now? Let me ask you that question.
For anyone who has never tried to read a modern piece of congressional legislation, I suggest that you do it. They're all available online, and it is one of the most daunting, disappointing experiences. Because
you mean
it
like
is
the Obama
the Affordable
healthcare
Care Act? Yeah, I actually tried to read
2,400 pages.
Well,
right?
But the amazing thing, like, they're very interesting things that they do that make it less accessible. It's not only that it's so long, and people argue about the number of pages. Like, some people say it's more in the 990 range, but when you go through it, a lot of these clauses are just references to other laws. But because the government is so not technologically savvy, it's not that it's even hyperlinked. So you would then like have to go and look up, figure out what that was, to figure out what it was referencing, then try and come back, and then, oh, you hit another one. So it's the 990 versus 2400 is a misleading thing, because in practice it's much, much longer than that, because you have to work through so many other laws to be able to even understand that original document. Oof.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. And then you have the growth of the regulations, too, which is what the administrative state has handed us, where even if Congress sometimes tries to make – and sometimes you're right that Congress makes language very vague and they obfuscate a lot of issues in order to perhaps not build public opposition to them. And then they just say, well, we'll just let the administrative agency take care of it. And then the administrative agency writes thousands and thousands of pages of regulations enforcing the very vaguely worded statute as well. So that's become a very big issue. That's one of the things that our IRS case tried to get to, was to try to say, listen, administrative agencies like the IRS and all the other alphabet soup agencies that exist here in D.C. do not have unlimited authority to just make up the law like they want to.
You know, Lawrence Lessig has called for a second constitutional convention, right? That we need to, like, essentially rewrite the Constitution or whatever. I'm sure that I think you would not agree with that in the same way that I don't know that you would agree with his proposal for how you deal with campaign finance, right, in terms of public funding.
Right, right. That is true. And you know, the big danger of the constitutional convention is what's going to happen. I mean, we have a pretty good – I mean, there's flaws in it. There's no question about it. But, you know, once you open it up again, then there could be all kinds of things that could be put into it. I would be happy – would not be a perfect world, but I would be happy with – interpreting the Constitution in the way that it was written, and to at least impose those limits on government to protect the rights that are set forth in the Constitution, and then, you know, we can talk about the amendment process or any changes.
I agree with you 100%. I'd be very, very careful about. I mean, I don't think there's been a philosophical idea that rivals the Federalist Papers, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. I mean, the older I get, the more I kind of like am exposed to the. Look, the Founding Fathers, that I guess it was a couple of months in June and July or whatever. I mean, those men mostly in their 30s, with the exception of Ben Franklin. I mean, what a bunch of geniuses.
Right. And you know, and also after the, you know, after the Civil War, too, you know, and some of the amendments, the so-called Civil War amendments that were passed as well after that were also like the second constitutional revolution, which really addressed some of the flaws in the Constitution, like well, they didn't institute slavery, but it certainly at least acknowledged its presence and didn't do anything about it. Of course, after the Civil War, the amendments were put into place that that prohibited slavery, but also then recognized this, the rights of all citizens and recognized the rights of citizens against their own state governments as well, which is something that the original Constitution only limited the powers of the federal government. And then through the 14th Amendment, you had provisions in there that said that no state, for instance, shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property, recognizing constitutional rights, as I said, for all citizens, regardless of where they live or their race, color, creed, and that sort of thing.
So, I mean, the point is you recognize that there is a process of changing and reinterpreting the Constitution, but the point is to do it through the mechanisms laid out in the Constitution rather than just like, because we feel like it.
As we feel like it, or and just making up things that just simply do not make sense. I mean, the classic example is the commerce power that's set forth in the Constitution. The Congress has the right to regulate commerce amongst the states. That was a freedom-enhancing provision. That was designed to try to, because some states at the time of the Articles of Confederation were setting up trade barriers between their states and said, well, you know, you can't buy goods across state lines because we want you to buy stuff from producers in our state. And they said, well, listen, we're not going to have this. You know, we're going to have an open market across a national market for it. And that's what that was designed to protect. But then that became an excuse to say, well, whatever Congress wants to do, that's regulating commerce, and that's the constitutional authority for whatever power Congress wanted to exercise.
Anybody, you know, if you talk to somebody who works with viruses or bacteria or anybody, any human being, I mean, we all want immortality. We all want to keep growing. I mean, bacteria has an interest in staying alive and do whatever it can, including adapt to its surroundings, adapt to its environment, not to call politicians bacteria and virus. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying that even at the base level of life, government will grow if we don't have people like yourself and institutions like the Institute for Justice out there keeping it in check. Unfortunately, as great as the Founding Fathers were, it seems that checks and balances alone don't work
unless you've got
a very active judicial
system. Well, but hold on. Let's talk about James Madison, Federalist Paper 51.
Oh, boy.
The greatest check on the government is the people. That is ultimately the final check. Is that not right,
that's
Scott?
That's where Scott Bullock comes in.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that we have to protect, and we have to carry on the constitutional traditions and preserve respect for that. Or you're right. I mean, the governments will just be able to run rampant. So you have to have a citizenry that understands the Constitution, and as I said, a court system too that is willing to exercise its legitimate authority to give life to those limits that are on government and that are in the Constitution.
I love it.
And I think the interesting thing is that, you know, while, you know, for example, the Institute for Justice and Lawrence Lessig might disagree on means, right, it's very clear that we've reached a moment where something needs to be done. Like, campaign finance has gotten out of control. The government size has gotten out of control. The size of the legal code, it's unnecessarily complex and serving special interests rather than the people. This is a moment when something needs to be done, right?
I think people are recognizing it. I mean, they see the failures of government before their eyes. I think that's one of the reasons why young people, as I mentioned, are becoming increasingly interested in this. They've seen in their lifetime, you know, the one kind of government debacle after another. And so, you don't have to look very far to see the failures of government. And people recognize that, you know, something has to be done about this. That shows up in polling, that, you know, people's frustration with Congress, with their own government. But, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is to channel that frustration to say, well, here's what really should be done. You know, mm-hmm. Here's what principles should be vindicated. And then we have this great guidepost here called the Constitution that sets forth what government should be doing and should not be doing, and here's the rights of folks that should be that should be protected. And you do have these rights that have been enshrined and recognized in the Constitution.
Oh, that's awesome.
So what should we do? We should come to the Institute for Justice website. We should watch your videos. Are there books we should read? What are next steps for us?
Absolutely. We've got a great website, as you had mentioned, YouTube channel. Our website is just very simple, ij.org, and that will direct you to a lot of information and also ways for people to get involved as well. We not just litigate and have a talk about these things in public and with members of the media. We also do activism and coalition building. And when we have a case, we go into the community and talk to folks about why we're there, what they can do to fight back against one of these things. So that's another thing too that I think libertarians have to become more active in is in these community fights as well, not just kind of talking about it or amongst their friends, but, you know, really going out and meeting folks and saying, hey, I think what's happening is outrageous. Let's fight together on this issue, even if folks might not agree with you on, you know, a broader range of issues as well. So there's definitely ways that people can become active in cases that in areas that we're involved in throughout the country. So that's ij.org. If you want to find out more about the forfeiture issue that we talked about toward the beginning, we have a dedicated website to that that's just endforfeiture.com. And that talks a lot about this growing awareness about forfeiture. And as we were talking about earlier, too, with the John Oliver piece that was just broadcast this past Sunday, we're on HBO that, you know, is extremely popular now online. It's gone viral. And he had a 15-minute dissection of civil forfeiture, talked about the Philadelphia case, talked about several other cases that we've worked on, and that's something, one of these things where, as you talked about in the beginning, both of you, of people hear about it and they just simply can't believe it. this would happen in this country.
Well, that is a good way to get people involved, get them mad, get them emotionally invested, and at least they'll wake up. So, and I know it did that for me, and I appreciate your work, and you're making the world a better place, Scott Bullock.
Hey.
A senior attorney.
And I have one last question for you.
Sure.
So as we start, you know, as the libertarian movement starts to grow, right, the problem that it faces is the problem that all third parties face, which is the current electional system, right? Do you feel like we need to reform the way that we elect our candidates so that there can be more parties in the political process?
Yeah, you know, I think I don't know. We don't, you know, get involved in those particular issues, so I haven't thought through, you know, exactly how the system should work. But absolutely, I mean, the more openness, the more freedom, the more ability for people to speak their mind and to cast ballots for whoever they wish, regardless of party identification, that is the way to go. And having, you know, the ability of folks to speak freely and to vote for who they wish, absolutely, I think is essential.
Rather than voting for the least bad candidate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scott Bullock, thank you so much for joining us. Come back anytime, man. That was awesome.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on, guys.
Very eye-opening, and you make the world a better place, like I said. Keep doing it, man. Keep doing it.
Thank you.
See you soon. or not.
Just hang up, Scott.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Bye, guys.
Scott, hang up for God's sake. No. Scott, thanks so much, buddy.
You got it. Thank you.
That was the kind of podcast we love because it's just important issues that really make a difference. So.
Great.
And because you're an awesome, eloquent speaker.
Indeed, with a strong baritone voice.
That's right. Brian, what part of the vocal register are you in?
I'm soprano. Kills me.
All Brian, right. Is it true that you're going to be performing the Queen of the Night aria?
Yes, I am. Just got to do my vocal warm-up. The first coffee and a sandwich, everyone. Bye-bye. It's Brian Callen.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.